This episode is brought to you by Fair Kitchens. Learn about the Fair Kitchens Code and join the movement at fairkitchens.com.
This episode is brought to you by you. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member today.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that's him. It's gonna get you some.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm Souther Teague.
I'm Greg Benson.
Hey, buddy. How are you?
I'm great, man. How you doing?
I'm great. We're going to be recording today sort of live from the future.
From the future.
Yeah, we normally are a live radio show, but today we're going to record one, and we're in Brooklyn. What neighborhood are we in, Brooklyn?
We're in... I actually looked this up. This is Borum Hill, which is not a neighborhood I think too much about. But yeah, we're right down the street from Grand Army. Should we say where we are?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we're in the back room of Clover Club, and the future is beautiful in here. It's great. I'd actually never been here before, but it's a very lovely, classy place run by lovely, classy people.
Shocked me.
Now I can't wait to go back. It's kind of shocked me. It's one of those. It's one of those things that has perpetually been on my to-do list, but I'm never in Borum Hill, the neighborhood that I didn't know the name of until I looked it up on the way over here.
But so, have you ever been to Leanda?
Also, never been to Leanda.
Literally across the street from here.
I know.
Also partners with Julian's is the Ivy Mix.
And I realized that on the way over here when I was looking up directions, I was like, oh, one stop shopping. Now I don't. Now when I come here, I can cross two things off my bucket list.
Yeah, it's easy. It's, you know, I don't know. I'm really shocked you haven't been here. Like crazy, but it's a beautiful bar.
It's
we're
gorgeous.
Lucky to be here today, and in our makeshift studio in the back room of the Clover Club, we're hanging out with Alexander Gabriel from Maison Ferrand. Hey, welcome.
Hello, great to be here.
God, you have such a great voice.
You think so?
You got a face for radio.
He's just saying you look like shit.
No, you look dapper as fuck, as always. And I know that, you know, the listener doesn't realize that we're doing this at just around 10 in the morning, which is unusual time for bar folk to be up and about. But you're here in the city to do a couple of things, one event here at Clover Club, and then you're going to go over and do something similar at Death & Company later in the afternoon. That's going to be amazing. You know, let's familiarize our listener with who and what you are. Like, give me some of your backstory. I know you came to America at a pretty young age.
Yes, I came the first time I was 18 years old, and I came here to learn English. I didn't speak English at all. I didn't do much progress since then, so I apologize to the listeners.
Well, you got dulcet tone, and you got this great accent. I'm sure you get far with just that alone. Plus, you're a pretty charming fellow.
Thank you.
So you came over, but you... Even as a youth, though, you grew up on a farm. I think that's going to be the run-through of your story, right?
It's true.
You're a farmer.
Yeah, I grew up on the farm with my grandparents and six cousins bouncing off the wall of a farm, you know, growing, making wine, but also, taking care of cattle in South Burgundy. And so, yes, making also goat cheese, you know, which I still love when it's super dry and nice. And so that's my background. That's where I come from.
That's pretty typical of every American, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Go up on a farm, make goat cheese, drink wine.
Yeah, live in an idyllic sitting with an extended family. You did that, right?
Yeah, we all did.
Yeah, exactly.
No, this is completely uncommon and unheard of, I think, for the people of America.
It sounds lovely, if I do say so myself.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds like the word you used, idyllic. So growing up on a farm, then you decided, as we said, to come to America to learn English. But that wasn't it. You came here to go to school as well, right?
Well, yes. You know, I grew up there in South Burgundy, went to school there, ups and downs in school. You know, not always was either love at first sight with teachers and would be like totally drilling in something, you know, because these teachers were just good match or you know, sometimes really rough. Don't take authority very, very well if it's not motivated. It's just, you know, my makeup. And so I've learned this in an early age, so I'm like, okay, what are you? You know, there's one person you have to deal with the rest of your life is yourself, right?
Correct,
so yeah. I knew I had to take care of this and try to do this right. You know, of course, you only connect the dots afterwards, right? And I was like, you know, I don't speak English. I'm like this basically French redneck. And yes, I love making wine. And really, I should... the only thing I can do is have my own little joint, whatever it is, and maybe a farm. My grandfather, very authoritarian guy, was still very young. He thought I'd be the next generation, but I wanted to get on with it. And so I just said, I got to, like, see the world. And to him, you know, a really father figure to me, really a mentor. He really taught me, like, you know, wealth is in the land. You know, something I remember all my life is, you know, when you work outside and so on, every weekend, every Wednesday afternoon, he always said, you know, keep something in mind. You don't own a vineyard, you tend a vineyard.
Sure.
And I look at life really like this, like, you know, it's a distillery. As you know, we distill in Cognac and also in Barbados where we make rum. And you go to this incredible old distillery on the beach, West Indies Rum Distillery, and you open the cupboards, you know, and you got like pictures of the different managers of the distillery for 120 years. They're all dusty, they're just sitting there. And you say, best case scenario, you'll be one of these men, you know, stuck in a drawer, drawer somewhere. And it's very humbling. And I really, to me, it's natural. This is the way it goes. And I think the world of spirits, whether you produce, you know, you produce cognac, the guys who have been starting doing this at the Ferrand family since 1630, right?
Yeah.
So we are nothing compared to this.
Yeah, yeah,
and so if you can bring your own little thing, you know, your own little touch to it and have fun and create a lot of good taste, beautiful, spirited emotions in the process, I think this is the best we can do.
Yeah, and like that requires like a tremendous amount of like foresight to be able to see it out that distance, but also patience, right?
Well, that's interesting because I'm actually not super patient.
Yeah,
and I don't.
I'm getting from you. You're like a hustler.
I don't have much foresight. No, honestly, you know, a lot of guys see and they say, I've been doing this for 30 years, right? And they tell you, you know, I knew from the beginning. I had no clue at the beginning. I mean, I had no clue. And I think most of us don't, right? You're there and you know what you don't like. I knew what I didn't like. I didn't like somebody who I felt, you know, just like blind authority telling me what to do if I was not on board. And it's funny because the way Maison Ferrand works, I'm surrounded by guys like me. We're like a bunch of misfits having loads of fun working so hard. It's like, you know, we wouldn't probably fit into a corporate environment, but we do something that we love and we do it all the way because there's just no looking back when you're into it. And we always double down, you know, we do something. And then you heard about what we're doing in Jamaica, for example, right now. You know, this is something that for us, it's a lot of it is do or die. So I was, go back to what we're talking about. I'm a late teenager and I'm thinking, I don't speak English, I don't know the world. So I went to America and I thought I would go to a place where there's not so many French people. I chose Minnesota and I thought
there's
I would...
not a lot of French people in Minnesota.
There's not a lot. I didn't discover a lot, yes, absolutely. And at first I thought I may die on the first year because of the weather.
Oh, yeah.
And it's actually a wonderful place. I enjoyed every minute of it. And there was Prince, you know, at First Avenue playing, at least twice a month. So I bought an old Le Mans, you know, beat-up car for $300. And,
you stuck with a French car, at least.
No, it was a Pontiac Le Mans,
I know,
the name. Yeah. Yes, and, just enjoyed the whole year. And I've learned, I mean, my English is not great, but I owe it to Minnesota, St. Paul, Minnesota. And learned English there and, you know, took audited at the McAllister College. English and politics just to, you know, do something and learn and just intern for a state senator over there, which was like really plunging into a culture, you know, which I thought was wonderful. And this is a wonderful country. And for me, you know, to come from Southern Burgundy and go into the Midwest, I thought it felt like home in a lot of ways.
I mean, I feel like that doesn't sound like home. It sounds like you went from a farm to, granted, Minnesota, not the most cosmopolitan, but you still went somewhere. You immersed yourself in a completely different culture and language. You dove into politics, which is not the easiest or most understandable thing. And you did all this as a teenager who grew up on a farm.
Well, you know, when you say dove into politics, I was a human word processor.
Yeah.
You know, I was, you know, at the Judiciary Committee. There was just an internship. And so, at the time there was no computer, so it was just cut and paste, physically cut and paste, you know, when they
with
were looking at laws. Yeah, with
and
scissors.
Glue. Cutting and pasting.
And whiteout was my third weapon, and, you know, so that's how I was equipped. And you know, I just fell in love with the culture. I thought that was great. And you know, you're just 19 years old. You just dive into it. And English started make sense to me quite quickly because, you know, when you're just the only thing that's around you. So I figured that's what it is. And very quickly I said, you know, after I do this year, I got to learn something about, I need to build my own little shack, whatever it is, you know, whether
sure.
it's a little farm or I was thinking South America or, you know, I grew up with winemakers, some genius winemakers and, you know, South Burgundy and so on. And I thought, you know, why not? But I was always fascinated by distilling. because to me, distilling is this, there's a magic to it. You know, it's about capturing the essence of things. And I just thought, this is crazy, you know. And my grandfather was what is called a bouilleur de cru, meaning that you have the privilege of distilling your own crop. So whether it was fruits or wine in that case, or actually the mustard wine, which we call Mar de Bourgogne. So I remember the smell of it, about doing this, and I felt, you know, maybe I can do something like this. Now it sounds a bit natural now because there's all craft distillers and so on. There was not such a thing 30 years ago, or actually it was a little over 30 years ago, 32 years ago back then, or 34. And so, but it's just, you feel maybe you could do this. But I had no clue about business. I didn't know. I mean, I had clues about how you do farming. But, you know, if you do spirits, it's very capital intensive. Like, you need money to do this. Yeah. And I didn't know
this. Well, again, especially if you're going to go into something that takes such a lengthy amount of time to get to market.
You're right. Exactly. Right? And that's
like,
why...
You're not distilling today and selling tomorrow.
Absolutely.
What's that thing? What's that thing? Oh, patience. That's what you need to
back
do.
Back to patience.
Yeah.
Yes. And also maybe, you know, planning, you know, that's very true. And also, and that's what we say to this day, you know, what I've learned is that it's like the same that on a farm. You can have an ideal view about what you do, and that's, I think, important in life. But we always say the head in the stars and the feet on the ground at Ferrand, because but farming also, you gotta make sure all the animals are fed and the plants are growing. And you know, that's something that's important.
The team is part of the animals, right?
No, I'm the animal, if you listen to them. And they're the humans.
Okay.
It's the other way around. And this great team, by the way, I'm so blessed. And really, thank you to all of them. And really what happened is that I just applied for a prep school, for business school, and just, I don't know, for some reason got accepted and went through it. But half into school, I was already a partner in a little cognac company that was Maison Ferrand. And I was doing at the time 20 or 30,000 euro or something worth of sales, and was basically a shadow of what it used to be. I mean, Ferrand is several branches, seven families. The main family is the Eli Ferrand branch, which we reconnected only recently with, actually. So really long story, really long adventure. And my first professional trip to Cognac was back then. And I saw farmland, and I saw a spirit that is the expression of its terroir. You see, Cognac has a map where every of the six area has a different taste profile, depending on the terroir in a greater sense, meaning the land, but also the hand of men and women making the products, which each different, slightly different know-how. And it just spoke to me. It makes sense. You know, sometimes you see something.
Yeah.
And again, a lot of guys says, well, you knew which was going to be it. Still, I think I'm going to say I don't really had a clue. You know, I just, I can tell you something a little personal, but my girlfriend at the time, who's actually my wife now, you know, she was there when, you know, came there sometimes with me, and we're so young and immature, you know, at night would like slide on the big corridors, you know, running and you know, and so it was not like the businessman with the big decisions, was somebody who's trying to find himself into something that he feel very passionate for. That was, I think, what was riveting to me all along, is that sense that I'm from my mother is an artist, she's a sculptor, and she's classically trained. And I always find that one of the beautiful things you can do is when you create emotions for others, you know. And I think it's very rewarding. My daughter is a musician, a professor, a musician here in the U.S. And I think when you can do this, you know, like when you distill something that's delicious, or when a bartender makes a beautiful drink, you know, I always love these moments. You know, there's an emotion. Usually it's a share emotions. And I feel that spirits is one of the last form of folk art. You see, now art has been harmonized worldwide, for the better or for the worse, really. Think about it. You know, if you go in a city, you listen to very similar rock and roll songs, and I love rock and roll, but, you know, you do. And if you look at, you know, or you go to Japan, one of the most best interpret of Bach by cello is Yo-Yo Ma, and so it's kind of a take on this, on a kind of same uniform culture. That's not true for spirits. With spirits, I think we saved the folk arts. You know, in Calvados, in the area, you drink Calvados, and Calvados been around. So it's like the folk music in the old days. Where I grew up in South Burgundy, we still play the very folksy music, But the guys who play it are 80 years old, and it's a music that's very different. You know, Ireland was able to keep it, but you see a lot of areas now, all this is wiped out, but it is not with spirits. Think about Baijo, think about Maldeburgheim, think Fyndeburgheim, think Armagnac, think... Some of them went worldwide, but they're really deeply rooted in their regional cultures. And think about bourbon, and think about Applejack. And I don't think spirits is magical that way. And I think you can create a lot of emotions if you distill a beautiful and age of beautiful spirits. And I felt it was a calling.
Well, yeah. that's like what your grandfather was talking about, too. It's like, you know, you don't... you make pop art. You don't make folk art. You tend folk art. You're just, you know, you're another rung in the legacy of it. You know, you're the keeper of the spirit, but it's not yours. It belongs to everybody. You know.
Yeah, it's true, and it's something you just carry on, right? And so of course you want to give it your twist, you know, or the one that your team and I think about. But really, it's a shared emotions. I mean, yesterday I was with a good friend Dave and joined by Garrett, and we're at the Long Island Bar here in Brooklyn. Just flew in from Paris to come here, see you guys, and we spent a great evenings having great cocktails. Probably a little too much, but still very enjoyable.
You still made it. It's early.
Exactly. It's if you made it to where you're supposed to be, it wasn't too
that
much.
That was what's important. But really, that's the moments you remember forever. And that's if we can help in the process with wonderful cognac, I think that's rewarding.
Yeah, incredibly rewarding, I'm sure. We're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. We're going to come back in just a second and keep talking to Alexander Gabriel from Maison Ferrand. Cognac. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Fair Kitchens. The food service industry faces a challenge. More people are eating out, yet restaurants are losing talent. Why is this? Research by Fair Kitchens reveals a serious well-being issue within professional kitchens. 74% of chefs are sleep-deprived to the point of exhaustion. 63% of chefs feel depressed. And more than half feel pushed to the breaking point. This can't be ignored. Fair Kitchens is a movement based on the belief that a positive kitchen culture makes for a healthier business. By taking the pledge to be a Fair Kitchen, they'll provide you with free information, tools, and resources to help you take action towards making your restaurant more stable, productive, and happy, which positively affects the guest experience. It's time to act now. Learn about the Fair Kitchens Code and join the movement at fairkitchens.com.
This episode is brought to you by you. Heritage Radio Network makes your favorite food podcasts. And now we need you to lend your voice to our community and show your support of food radio. Become a member today. HRN releases 35 weekly shows each week and is a globally respected voice in food media. But believe it or not, we're still a very small grassroots organization. HRN is powered by a small but mighty staff of 4 people and HRN's incredible hosts who volunteer their time to bring you the best food podcasts out there. Our hosts are experts in their field, whether it's food writing, mixology, culinary history, craft beer, LGBTQ issues, and so much more. And they're committed to making sure that the stories that matter to you keep coming each week. We believe that a thoughtful, committed group can change the world. So join us. Add your voice and support HRN by making a donation of any amount. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
And we're back on the Speakeasy at recording live from the future at Clover Club in Boreham Hill. We're hanging out with Alexander Gabriel of Maison Ferrand. Alexander, we just talked and learned a lot about you, about your youth. You're still a young man, but about your young youth. And now we're going to talk a little bit more about what it is you're up to today. Where you've taken and where you plan to take the House of Ferrand.
Well, it's been 30 years this year, so a fascinating 30 years, an incredible team, like I said, very proud of each and everyone. And
But I still want to like impress upon the audience that 30 years in the world of cognac is like 10 minutes.
It is 10 minutes. It is like the life of a fly. Yeah, exactly.
Like 30 years is just a tiny incremental part of the motion of the wheel, right?
It totally is, and I'm so convinced about it. I just finished with a good friend, the historian Jacques Blanc, a book about the history of the that we're writing, a book about the history of Grand Champagne of Cognac. The Grand Champagne of Cognac is the bullseye of the Cognac region. And it's a fascinating history because it's a team of disenfranchised people. They were the Huguenots of France, and they were ostracized, often killed if they didn't admit that they were didn't become Catholic.
Right.
And at the risk of their life, you know, continued on their faith and their mission of making great cognac, and their cousins were the Huguenots that immigrated, and they created, you see that life has created this wonderful spirit, and you see how it's intertwined, especially in this bullseye of the Cognac region, and that's the Grand Champagne. So you really see these people starting in the early 1600s. Now there's a history of one, the main branch of the Ferrand family, which was this little distillery that we took over about 30 years ago. And they were doing this for since 1630, you know, and this idea of creating a product.
They're new at it.
And now, exactly, that was the new, that was the
young,
the beginners,
scrappy upstart.
The beginners, this upstart, 1630. So yes, of course, it's very, 30 years is very little. And right now, I'm here because we're launching a new product called 10 Generations in the honor, something cognac I blended in the honor of Mademoiselle, which was the last living direct generation of the Eli Ferrand branch. And she passed away with no heir, and she was like a godmother to us. And, you know, and she's just still the old estate house where she lived all her life that that now we're keeping a bit like a shrine, to tell you the truth. And to us, she's still alive, and I made this blend in her honor.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And that's amazing. And that also speaks to something you spoke to a bit earlier as well. Like you have this kind of firm belief that it's about emotion, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So she passed on, and you became emotional, and then you created something to carry her on, right?
That's exactly it. And, you know, she always said to me, when I went there, she remembers the birthday and of all of our ancestors 10 generations before her.
Wow.
And one day I'm like, Mademoiselle, how can you, you know, if you tell me how can I have that kind of memory at your age? She was close to 100 years old. And I'm like, this is, and she says, you know, when you don't have any children, your children is your legacy. So I think I'm just walking in a very modest way in these footsteps, my team and I. We decided to do this plan called 10 Generations. And, you know, as you know, I do a lot of research about the way cognac was made in the old days and also the way rum was made in the old days. I love to, because to me it's such a source of inspirations. And so we employed an old techniques, which was reuse wine barrels. You know, in the old days, you didn't throw anything away. You know, my grandmother, who lived through Second World War, and grandfather that was a father that was a husband, I'm sorry, which was my grandfather, who was a prisoner of war. You know, you reuse everything.
Yeah.
You know, you don't throw anything away. So in the old days, it was like that. So they would reuse their wine barrels, and then so 20% of that blend is a cognac that's aged in a barrel of Sauternes wine.
Mm.
And so it's a blend, and it's a higher proof, you know, a little spikier, it's a 92 proof. So it's something that I felt, you know, would really reflect all of this, put together the heritage, the research about ancient techniques of cognac making. It's 100% Grand Champagne, Premier Cru, like all the Ferrand cognac. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ferrand is really a specialist of this, you know, unblended Premier Cru area where we are located, where our vineyards, and do something the higher proof to have a little more concentration, I thought really was on target. And that's the way I looked at it, really. And the fact that, you know, this is a family that all called each other's Eli, you know, in 1630, Eli the first, and then the last one died in the Dardanelles, male heir was Eli the 10th.
Wow.
So Eli, so that's why, 10 generations,
yeah.
Right? So, Eli the 8th was like a greater than life guy that we have a lot of writings about. There's a book I'll show you, it's right here, about him. It's a 300 page book, and we see the kind of research that he was doing that was at the time quite common, but that's forgotten now. For example, using barrels made of chestnut to make cognac, which is a delicacy, and it is not part of the cognac regulation now. And so, of course, Cognac React, you know, we're as a team, all the producers, and I'm modestly trying to see if we can reopen the nowadays regulation to be able to key in some of these ancient practices that yet they are very niche, you know, they're very specific, but it makes such delicious spirits, such delicious cognac. And I, of course, it was my little midlife crisis. I did another product called the Renegade Barrels, which is all these ancient practices that we're digging out. Why Renegade? Because if you look at the history of a lot of these different Ferron, they were kind of the renegades of their times. And it's kind of a, you know, a bit of a wink to them and to say, if you plunge back in these old recipes and traditions that are not part of nowadays life anymore, are you a traditionalist or a renegade? I don't know, but it's delicious cognac, and that's what we made it. In that case, we can't call it cognac. We have to call it
eau
de vie de vin.
Because of the rules, right? The rules are they laws or are they just rules?
They're laws.
Yeah,
they're laws.
So just like we have with American whiskey, it's the BNIC, right?
Yeah, you're right.
So now you...
Yeah.
I got to visit Maison Ferron.
Absolutely.
I'll tell you a story about a tomato real fast. But I was on the property. They were showing us the vineyards, and I saw this tomato bush. I grew up in the deep south, you know, and tomatoes are like a big deal for us. And I thought to myself, those tomatoes are growing in the best place on earth for a fruit to grow. Tomatoes are fruits. And I said, can I have one of those? And the guy was, yeah, take one. So I plucked one off there, and I ate this little tomato that was probably the best tomato I've ever had in my life because it had to struggle to grow, which is what the soil
yes,
does,
right?
The soil makes the fruit
chalky soil, yeah.
So, so
the struggling tomato.
I'm curious if you guys would maybe chop down a row of vines and put up a row of tomatoes. No, probably not.
That's what was done right there.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. There's just one little bush. Yeah, yeah. Inside. I can't even believe I saw it. I was like, what is that over there? So what... Maybe this comes back to a little bit of you got some politics in your background. Do you use any of that savvy or that style of talking when you reach out to the BNIC and say, hey, can we reopen these old
they might ways? They might agree with you. I don't know. It's a wonderful team. Again, you know, 30 years ago, I wouldn't have said that. I must admit, you know, I was pretty rebellious. I think now it's a matter of really sitting down and trying to agree on something, which is not always easy, as you can imagine. And a lot is at stake, so I can respect that. But to us at Ferron, we feel it's a calling. I know we probably think I'm crazy. It probably is the case, but we feel it's a calling to be able to do this and to do it well. You know, I always say to my team, we don't do things halfway. Like if we do this, we do it all the way. And so that's why I'm writing this book. I'm insomniac. I don't sleep well at night.
My grandmother, same. I sleep about 4 hours a night.
Well, my grandmother was the same way. She lived almost 100, so don't worry.
Yeah, we're good.
And so I wrote this book with Jacques about the history of Grand Champagne, and I'm starting one about the different type of woods, you know, chestnut, acacia, mulberry, cedar, where they were used. Cedar. Yeah, cedar was very big vats. Mostly for rum. You know, to store rum like a couple of years and things, it gives a slight little twist. And we have this historical data at the distillery in Barbados, because as you know, we're involved and we teamed up with the West Indies Rum Distillery in Barbados, so also incredible history. So at Maison Ferron, what we do is there's so much to draw from this, and I've done it for 30 years, and that's our products, all the Ferron products are the result of all this research and talent of a team, I'm proud to say. And so whether it is the 10 generations that we described, or for example, we have a product called Double Cask, where it goes through a second aging in a Banyuls barrel. So now Banyuls, you probably know, is a tiny little region in south of France where they've been making wine since the 1300s, and they still make wine the same way.
Yeah.
And so,
it's
not on trellis, it's still on the ground, and this wine is so rich, and it's got a lot of what we call the rancio, which is these very ripe notes of, dried fruits like prune, etc. So if you use a barrel of this specific wine, and you put an old cognac into it as a maturation, a double maturation, it's delicious. That's the reserve double cask that we do like this, again, the reuse to certain barrels. So it's really a tribute to this great heritage and that we're doing and that we're spending our life doing.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about that rum project that you touched on, because I'm getting a sense that you have kind of a rebellious streak in you when it comes to making these spirits and kind of like seeing, you know, okay, let's reach back and maybe push the envelope a little bit and see, like, let's try some of these old techniques and see how far we can stray from the past while still honoring it. what was that like for you to come and start working with this distillery in Jamaica? Because, you know, it's not exactly the Wild West, but it certainly doesn't have as many rules and regs as I imagine making cognac does. Was that kind of you, like, I imagine you, like, rubbing your hands together. It's like, all right, let's get weird with this. How was that?
Well, it's true. I mean, rum is a spirit that I fell in love with 25 years ago. And I wanted to learn. You know, I've worked in my life with 50 different master blenders and master distillers in different projects that we've done together. Sometimes we launch a product together. Sometimes we just drink the barrel, and both is a lot of fun. And you know, Dave Pickrell, the late Dave Pickrell, for example, in the U.S. comes to mind, but many other people. I was with Garrett last night from Brooklyn Brewery, an incredible gentleman.
Garrett Oliver, he's awesome.
Yeah, something's going to come out of this evening of yesterday.
You know, we're going to because he likes to fuck around. With shit
exactly.
Too.
So we're going to swap barrels and, you know, so we'll do some crazy stuff. So you know, about 20 years ago, when I thought, you know, maybe I fell in love with rum, and I said, what if we did an old technique for rum, which is really use not just bourbon barrels, but actually use our cognac barrels to mature rum. And then we started, as soon as we could do it, and that was later on, we shipped the rum inside the barrel. When rum spends a lot of time at sea in a barrel, the movement of the humidity gives it an incredible polish. Mm-hmm. The old guys knew it. Now science is only starting to realize how much good it does to the spirit. And so that's when we created Plantation Rum. That was 1999. At the time, it was tiny, tiny. And then, of course, we grew. And being a production guy, one day I said, you know, wouldn't be so nice if we can invest in a distillery. So I thought about this quite a long time ago, really almost from inception. And then it's like getting married, you know, you want the perfect match and you're looking at it. And
got to book the venue and everything.
Exactly. And we're saving some money. And because we didn't want to do like what business people call leverage buyout, where the distillery would have to struggle to pay the loan. Or we really wanted the distillery to strive and the money to stay in the Caribbean. So we invested in West Indies Rum Distillery just over 2 years ago. And West Indies Rum Distillery, which in thirsting spells like weird when people, some of weird stuff you're talking about. So we're doing weird rum, literally.
West Indies rum.
Yes, and so weird West Indies rum. Distillery is an old distillery on the beach that's been around, was a brainchild of a gentleman in the late 1800s about making the best rum there is. This distillery contains archives of rum making since then. There's a room called the Vault, it's all there. There's some crazy stuff in there, like making rum with using seawater in the fermentation process. All this stuff is right sitting there. We have the oldest chamber still in the world. There's only one remaining from the 19th century. It's there. It's not a pot still. It's not a common still. Dave Wondrich, an incredible historian and spirit, I call him the intellectuel gourmand, has documented this.
The
intellectual gourmand.
Did
you hear French?
Intellectual, gourmand intellectuel. Ah, you know, so somebody who's an intellectual guy but has incredible taste buds. And so, you know, we've done a lot of research together. So that distillery to us was it's like a marriage with the team. There's now 70 guys there, so much bigger than who we were actually in size. And you'll see in my life, we always double up, you know, because it's a team. It's a team. We put everything with the team. And I made a pledge to my team 30 years ago to never take dividends, and we're not. We're just plunging every cent back to the community. Amazing. And for us, we made the same pledge to the team in Barbados, which we have, you know, now it's almost 3 years. And so luckily, this very old lady, which is this distillery, own the third national rum of Jamaica in Jamaica. So imagine this little redneck from South Burgundy. I'm now sitting at a table and working with the government of Jamaica, who owns a third. An incredible gentleman right now, represent the government, probably three times smarter than I am. And then my good friend Kamal Samaru from Demerara Distillers, which also is a third owner. So it's the three of us. And with an incredible team in Jamaica, as well as in Barbados, and we tried to work all together to make great rums, and that's Plantation. So, yes, a lot of moving parts, but a very, very, very exciting adventure for sure.
And successful, right? You're making delicious stuff, and it's getting to the people.
Well, you know, I hope so. Again, you know, in the end, it's the emotions. And we launched in honor of this marriage, Jamaica Special Dry, and I'm going to brag a little.
Do it.
You know, it's a... It's been launched 12 months ago, and we already have 12 gold medals and more. So again, a tribute to the team, because yes, I'm a master blender by training and I do my part, but I wouldn't be nothing without these guys and their passion and that we share. So yeah, Plantation has been growing, and it's very humbling, you know, because you always, like, since we're doubling up and we're resting everything, it affords us to be able to do more things. And right now in Jamaica, you know, we're cultivating more land, more cane land, and it is more people. In Barbados, we're able to employ 40% more people. And I'm very proud of this, to see this team that's really excited. I was just in, you know, the distillery in Black Rock in Barbados last week, and there's a new lady who works do analysis in yeast and at the lab, and she's from Barbados. She just came back from Canada, and she was so excited to join the team. And that excitement, you're like, this is infectious. You know, it feeds me back. So that's the adventure.
Yeah, you're building something that's, you know, has an effect on a lot of people's lives. Both on the business side and on the consumer side, right? When the bottle finally lands, either, you know, at the local liquor store or the bar, those emotions get to carry on, right?
Totally, you know.
Pick them up.
The emotions we're trying to create are the same that the bartender imagine. I sometimes sit in a corner of a bar, and it's a quiet time, and there is a consumer comes and they say, "I'd like a vodka and tonic," for example. And then the bartender says, "Sure," says, "Can I make you something else? And if you don't like it, I'll drink it." And then you make something with gin or with, you know, rum or cognac or tequila. And that person's face brightens up and says, "What is this? It's delicious." And, you know, that moment, this person is different from before they entered the bar and they left the bar. And the satisfaction of this barmaid or bartender, you know, that made this delicious drink, and that person leaves and is thinking, "Wow, you know, this person leaves this place, I'd like to believe, as a better person." Well, if we can do the same with a beautiful cognac, with Ferrand cognac, or beautiful rum, with Plantation rum, I think that's what we're about.
Yeah, I also love the fact that you sort of, like, you're very willing to seem to sort of stick and move, right? You're always on the move. So, like, talk to me a little bit about the fact that the laws that the BNIC has laid down dictate that you can't distill during certain times of the year. And so you've got these stills just sitting there getting dusty, and you said to yourself, "Fuck that, I'm going to do something." And you started making gin.
Yeah, that was 1996, probably way, way too early. See, we never had a marketing department until this very fine lady, Angélique, came and joined, and she convinced me that maybe marketing is a good thing. To me, it was I must apologize to all marketing people listening. I just thought, you know, I could buy another 50 barrels instead, you know, having a marketing department. And to me, it was a no-brainer, you know. So for 28 years, that was the choice. And then she came and she says, "Actually, people could understand much better what we're doing.
If you explain it to them.
So
suddenly, that?
And I was like,
"How
really? That sounds exactly." And, you know, the team used to do presentations. They would go to Kinko's and prepare their brochure, basically,
with
like
your
just
old
before.
Cut-based skills.
Exactly.
Still got the old trusty bottle of white hat.
That was that's what it was.
Yeah, just,
until 2 years ago, really, until 2 years ago. So, of course, now no more, sorry for Kinko's, now it's working differently. And you know, she convinced us, and so it's the same thing. For us, no marketing studies, and we decided, let's use these pot stills to make gin, right? Because for half of the year, you don't distill cognac, and it just sit there. It's beautiful equipment, great know-how, very eager, a lot of eagerness, as you can imagine. So I tried to learn everything I could about gin making. I remember all my life being in the UK out of a distillery that's an old distillery in London, and there is a funeral procession driving by, in a very British humor, a gentleman that was very, very old says to me, "Here goes gin customers." You know, they were like, his customers were just, he's like, that was not a really vibrant market back then.
Sure.
And now there's a new gin every day, and you know, and it's a very vibrant market. So I really think, you know, the way I look at it, I never worried where the market goes, and maybe it's stupid. We just did things that we felt was right and made sense to us. And that was our line conduct, probably bad advice, you know, I don't know. But that's been our conduct. So we launched Citadel Gin in 1996. I remember talking to a distributor here, Mike Shaw, here in New York. And I said, you know, Mike, we have this gin. Finally, we're able to convince the government. It took me 5 years. We can distill into a cognac still to make this gin. What do you think? You know, and to us, it was like one of the marvels of the world because we spent so much time and research to do it. We actually have a, they have a patent under my name. There's only four or five in the world for gin making. And so we felt, this is it, you know. And we have the recipe, and we've arrived. And he looked at me and says, what is that shit? And I'm like, you know, it's a nice French expression. So I'm like, well, this is a gin, you know. And I explain, you know, it's distilled on a naked flame. And he looks at me and he says, it sounds like a sexual transmitted disease, Alexander. French gin distilled on a naked flame. Does that hurt? And I'm like, all right, maybe, you know, so maybe the marketing skills that we've got to work on it. And then, but I remember because a few weeks later, I met somebody who was writing for the New York Times, and I guess maybe I was, took pity of me, a little bit down, and loved Ferrand Cognac, so always was very fond about the cognac. And he said, what's up? And I said, well, and then tell this person the story. And that was 1999, actually, a few years after. And he tastes the gin and says, this is the best gin I've ever tasted. I'm like, really? I'm like, well. And so he wrote this beautiful article, half page. I still have it. I'm a little superstitious in the drawer of my desk. You know, was, I remember Citadel, Gin, Stones, the Gate. And it created a little bit of interest until a gentleman called Fern Adria, who's an incredible chef in Spain, El Bulli at the time. Yeah. And made on TV what he thought, you know, like gin and tonic is a gastronomic act, and he's whipping out a bottle of Citadel gin. And I don't watch, you know, I live in Cognac, so I didn't watch the Spanish television, but our Spanish distributor calls me and says, you won't believe this. Fran Adria made a gin and tonic on TV using Citadel gin. And I'm like, wow, that sounds great, right? Well, he's like Ronaldo over there. He's like, he's like a rock star. And suddenly we started, and he's actually, people don't know this, but actually Ferrand Adria is the gentleman that invented what we call the Spanish gin, like gin and tonic, you know, like this, you know, when you drink it
in a big goblet.
Right, in a big wine glass, or, you know, because he says it's about the aromatics and the full experience. So we're like, oh, that's exciting, you know, and then we started, at first we sold just a few cases, we started selling by pallets, which was really exciting, so we cranked up production. And this year we're putting a distillery that's going to be full-time distilling because the seasonal distilling, the young guys working with me now because a lot of guys started with me retired, and they're like, no, we want to be able to distill all year long. So I started November or December 2020, we'll be able to also continue to distill all year long because Citadel has grown.
Because the demand, yeah. That's outstanding. You know, I'm a partner in a bar here in New York called Windmill, which is all the spirits we use are French, so the only gin we have there is Citadel.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, that's an honor. Thank you very much.
And we do the Spanish-style gin tonic in the goblet.
Yeah, in the goblet. It's gorgeous. Well, we owe this to Fran Adria, absolutely. That was his first, and you know, a lot of chefs walked in his footsteps.
Oh, of course.
He was really carried on in Europe by the gastronomy at first, and Belgium, Flanders, very gastronomic area, were the second area to, and then it kind of migrated progressively.
Yeah, I visited San Sebastian a few years ago, and I tell people without hesitation that the gin tonic in San Sebastian changed my DNA. Like, it changed my perspective on that simple drink so radically.
It's a great experience, right?
I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, for the listener, if you haven't had a Spanish-style gin tonic, it's an experience.
Some of them bring a trolley with different herbs and different ingredients.
I visited a bar called Gin Tonneria. They had 132 gins and 132 gin tonics, a gin tonic recipe for each gin. Like, incredible.
Yeah.
Like, it's just incredible the thought process that they use to create this sort of like to sort of like elevate this simple thing to like a little piece of art.
Yeah, there is a...
Man, you want to talk about emotions, man.
That's a lot of
emotion. That's a lot of emotion.
It's funny you remind me, but I haven't been there for a long time. It was probably 10 years ago. There's a bar in a restaurant. It's more like a restaurant, simple restaurant called Padre in Madrid. And so Padre is the father. He owns this farm outside of Madrid with his two sons. And you can see that he works them real hard, probably slaps them in the back of the head once in a while. You know, you can see like they're like working so hard for their father. And they have to be talking about tomatoes. They're like, they grow, you know, over there, tomatoes, they melt you know, with oil and things. So they prepare these gin tonics with things that they grow in their farms, different ingredients. That was heavenly.
Yeah.
You know, that like local ingredients, and then gin works, will lend itself to that very, very easily.
Of course. And I'm a big fan of the Citadel gin.
Thank you.
And that's why I have it over at Windmill. Well, listen, this has been a really great and fascinating talk with you. You're just, the trail of your life is pretty incredible. And, you know, it's not even halfway over. So we're expecting more great things from you. If anyone wanted to get a hold of you or to talk to you about cognac or gin or rum, is there an easy method? You got an Instagram handle?
I'm not good with Facebook messages, but I'm on Facebook to share a little bit of what I do. I'm learning, you know.
you got your marketing people.
I'm learning to do the pictures and share what we do. We love passionate people, and if anybody, makes it to France or Barbados, we're not open to the public, but we're open to passionate people. And always, we love to share this passion. You know, it's wonderful. And I got an email, it's agabriel@maisonferrand.com. So, of course, I'm always sometimes slow with email, because if it's, very often either at production or here, talking about what we do.
Sure.
And my mother always said, when you're a creative guy and you create something, you got to be the best at it, but you have to know how to speak about it. So I've learned this. That's why I've learned English, by the way. Otherwise, you're a poor artist in the somewhere, which that's the story of her life. And very inspiring to me again to be able to speak about what we're doing. So we'd love to share the experience.
Yeah, I had a wonderful, wonderful experience when I got to visit the house, Maison Ferrand. It was unbelievable. And now you've set up is there something for people to come and visit now?
Well, when was this?
6, maybe 7 years
ago. You stayed with us or not?
Because we fixed. I don't think that was finished yet.
Yeah, that was not finished. Because what we did, we're so broke 6, 7 years ago. Because
yeah.
We go through different phases of adjustments. We do all the work ourselves, so I got 4 of my guys. When they don't fill up barrels, they fix up things.
Sure.
So next time you come, you can stay with us. We fixed up 9 bedrooms at the chateau, at the estate. So it's all done by ourselves. So, it's not like 5-star hotels, but it's nice.
Yeah.
And, it's right in the middle of the vineyards. And
it's fucking gorgeous.
We borrowed from American culture the fire pit, so we have a fire pit. that was something that was fun. And we're building right now. It's going to be soon ready. A road tennis, it's a Barbados tradition where they play. It's a mix of tennis and ping pong. It's like kind of the road. When the Barbados people saw the British playing tennis in the etc. in a fancy way, they said we're going to play tennis too. And they played it on the road, doing a plank in the middle, and they play it with a rubber ball and like a rackets built into like a plank of wood. And it's such a fun sport, and became our, emblematic sports at Maison Ferrand. So we have a field at the distillery, across the distillery in Barbados, and we're building one in Cognac because the Cognac team wants to be able to compete.
Sure.
So you'll be playing road tennis.
Could have a championship between the two distilleries.
That's what we're doing.
Yeah. Nice.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
Well, again, really, really excellent having you on the show today.
Great.
Thank you so much for taking some of your time out. I know you're busy while you're on the road, and again, it's early morning, and I'm glad we got to catch you, and I hope you have a great success while you're here and get everything done you need to get done. That's it for this week's Speakeasy team. Thanks so much for joining us, and tune in next week. Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thank you.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows that you like. Tell your friends. And please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.